and this Monday morning, and welcome everybody here today for a for an orientation on the lottery, and also we have before us a review of the tax expenditure report. There's already been substantial discussion about the tax expenditures and the role of the tax expenditure report this session, so I asked Paul to spend some time with us this morning with the tax expenditure report as committee. So let's begin with the review of the and orientation on the lottery. And who's coming forward?
Actually, we have the tax expenditure report first.
Of course, that's why it's listed second
yes,
on the agenda. All right, okay. Then let's do that.
Okay.
Just pick in charge.
Yes. Mr. Chair, you have a copy of the tax expenditure report, which I think you've all received. Came out at the same time as the governor's budget came out a couple weeks ago. The tax expenditure report was first done in as a interim project by Legislative Revenue Office following the 95 session, I believe, and then was put into, or maybe following the 93 session, it was put into statute in the 95 session, and the Department of Revenue was directed to update this report on a biennial basis and to release it the same time the governor budget comes out. So now that's become a regular part of the budget process. Now the report is done by the Department of Revenue, and I've asked Craig Fisher, who's the manager of the research section and who has overall responsibility for the report, to go through it with us.
Very good. Please come forward, Mr. Fisher.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Craig Fisher. I'm the research manager for the Department of Revenue. As Paul mentioned, I'd like to give you an overview today of the tax expenditure report to help point out those aspects of it that I think can make it a useful resource as you consider the tax system. The concept of the tax expenditures really applies to those provisions of tax law that impart some special treatment to a group of taxpayers. Income that's excluded from taxation or deductions or credits or property tax exemptions are all the types of things that are considered tax expenditures. And they are termed tax expenditures because they have a similarity to direct spending. That is, if you provide a particular benefit to a group of taxpayers, like a pollution control credit, for example, that can be seen as the equivalent of direct spending for environmental quality purposes. So the term tax expenditure derives from that similarity to direct spending.
Kathy, can I ask you to bring the lights down a bit? Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. The concept is not a new one. The federal government has produced tax expenditure reports for about 30 years or so, and most, or approximately 35 states produce them as well. As we'll see later, Oregon's has probably some of the more comprehensive requirements for the publication of this report, but it's not a new concept at all. As Paul mentioned, the origin of this particular report was in the Budget Accountability Act that was passed in the 1995 session. That act basically identified that there was a similarity, or noted the similarity between tax expenditures and direct spending. Another thing that act did was it required that the governor submit to the legislature each session this publication along with the recommended budget. So that also points out the linkage between the direct spending. The idea is that the governor presents the recommended budget, which describes the direct spending, and the tax expenditure report, which has some of these indirect spending components in it. And the Budget Accountability Act also directs the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Revenue to assist the governor in the preparation of this report. This is the specific reference in the Budget Accountability Act that describes tax expenditures. It really, I won't read the whole thing here, but it is any law of the federal government or the state that exempts in whole or in part certain persons, income, goods, services, or property from the impact of established taxes. And then it provides some examples, as I mentioned before, deductions and exclusions, credits, property tax exemptions, et cetera. The thing I'll point out is that this is a fairly broad, you'll notice that it includes any law of the federal government. And as I'll talk about later, since Oregon ties to the federal definition of taxable income, that means any exclusion or deduction that's defined at the federal level will then flow through and be a tax expenditure in Oregon. So this isn't just Oregon-specific statutes that are pointed out here. It's any law of the federal or state that provides these exemptions. So it's a fairly broad definition. I've got a chart here that kind of breaks down the relative size of the tax expenditures in Oregon. This is for in our most recent 2003-05 report. And as you can see, there are, in the first column here, I've broken these down into general categories. We've got income tax, property tax, and then there are a variety of other taxes that we include in our report. There are 15 taxes in total. But as you can see, of the 350 total tax expenditures that we report about, almost 200 of them are in the income tax program, over 100 of them are in the property tax program, and then there are a handful in a variety of the other programs, the gasoline tax, the weight mile tax, cigarette tax, and there's a few of those, a total of 41. So you can see the predominance of the income tax program in the amount of the expenditures. The column right next to the number of tax expenditures, titled Estimated Revenues, gives you an idea of what the most recent projection for receipts are for each of these programs. So the December OEA forecast for income tax revenues, this is both personal income tax and corporate income tax, is that $8.4 billion. The projection for property tax is about $6.6 billion, and all of these other taxes combined represent about $3.4 billion for a total of $18.46 billion. The final column here then shows the rough approximate value of these tax expenditures in each of these categories. So there is about $6.9 billion of tax revenue essentially has been removed through the income tax expenditures. Under the property tax row, you'll notice that there's $18 billion of tax expenditures there. This is a little bit skewed by some extremely large exemptions, property tax exemptions. In fact, of that $18 billion, there's about a little over $10 billion of an intangible personal property exemption. That is financial accounts, which is checking accounts and stocks. There's also business intangibles. It's a huge tax expenditure, and it, in some sense, skews the totals there a bit.
And under the property tax, that would also then include special valuation, farm, that is agricultural land, forest land, those and other special use valuations. Those would be included in that $18 billion?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This includes partial exemptions, full exemptions, and special assessments. There are also, like for example, federal properties included in this one, which is over $3 billion. The state is not allowed by law to tax federal property. So, to a certain extent, that $18 billion is a large number, but it would be worth noting that that's influenced by half a dozen or so very large individual, sort of unique tax expenditures. And then finally, in the other tax category, you can see of the $3.4 billion that is anticipated in revenues for those categories, there's only about $40 million of tax expenditures. Those other programs don't have a very large amount of tax expenditures. So knowing that that's sort of generally how they're broken down, I'd like to talk a little bit about the income tax expenditures a little more fully, if I could. If you think of this bar as essentially representing potential revenue from the income tax, it's close to $16 billion. And if you look at the bottom blue box, that's that $8.4 billion that we expect to receive in the 2001-03 biennium. And so if you sort of think about this, sort of flows through how the tax calculation actually works, where there's some income that's excluded from taxation at the federal level. And that's that top box that represents about $3.2 billion of taxes. And examples of the kinds of federal exclusions are employer-provided medical care. That's not a taxable item, but it can be seen as compensation. Scholarship income, Social Security benefits, public assistance benefits. This is all income that is not taxed at the federal level, and because we tie to the federal definition of taxable income, it is also considered, it's not taxed in Oregon, and isn't considered a tax expenditure. Moving down to the sort of aqua box there, that is federal deductions. That represents about $1.7 billion of lost Oregon tax revenue, or foregone Oregon tax revenue, if you will. And these are things such as charitable contributions, mortgage interest deduction for medical and dental expenses, There's Section 179 expensing allowances, which allows small business to expense small amounts of property instead of depreciating them, and deduction for property taxes. So when you look at those top two boxes, you have a total of about $4.9, almost $5 billion that is essentially excluded or deducted from the Oregon base because of our connection with the definition, federal definition of taxable income. Moving down to the pink box then, these are Oregon-specific subtractions. We have about 29 of these Oregon subtractions in Oregon law, and they include federal pension income, the federal income tax deduction, interest on federal obligations. There's an additional medical subtraction for the elderly, and Oregon actually allows a deduction for all of Social Security benefits. The federal exclusion is only a partial exclusion for Social Security benefits, so Oregon takes that a little bit further. But that amounts to about $1.1 billion in total, those Oregon subtractions. And then finally, there are Oregon credits. We have about 56 Oregon-specific credits, and they total about $1 billion of tax revenue here. And examples of those include the earned income credit, pollution control credit, political contribution credit, and a credit for contributions to the Trust for Cultural Development. So there's 56 of those in total. So this, I think a couple of things from this chart is it shows how significant I think our tie to the federal definition is. In fact, of the 192 expenditures in the federal on the income tax program, 107 of them result from our tie to the federal definition of taxable income. Okay, I'd like to step through a little bit, if I could, the information that's required for each tax expenditure in this report. The report requires that the statutory authority be provided for each of these expenditures. We have to state what the purpose of each tax expenditure is. We have to produce revenue loss estimates for each of the expenditures. And these estimates are to be generated for the current biennium, in this case the 01-03 biennium, and also for the next biennium, the 03-05. And I'll talk a little bit in more detail about the revenue loss estimates and how there are some issues around them later. Each of the expenditures is to be grouped according to the programs or functions. And this ties back to that linkage between the tax expenditures and the direct spending. That is, there's a desire to line these up with the categories that are used in the recommended budget. And so we're instructed to group it in that way. Each expenditure is to be evaluated for effectiveness. This is actually something that I think makes Oregon's tax expenditure report stand out, I think, a little bit. There are a few reports that I'm aware of that attempt to evaluate the effectiveness of these. A lot of state reports really are essentially a catalog. They describe them and provide revenue numbers. But the Public Accountability Act, or the Budget Accountability Act, requires an evaluation of effectiveness. And these actually have to be evaluated along two lines. They're supposed to be evaluated according to whether each expenditure accomplishes its purpose and whether each expenditure is the most fiscally effective means of accomplishing its purpose. So there's those two elements that are required here. An analysis of who benefits is required by the Act. And finally, for those tax expenditures that are scheduled to sunset or they'll go away in the next biennium, the Act requires that the governor provide a recommendation about whether or not the sunset should be allowed to happen or whether the sunset should be extended. So that's the information that for each of these 350 tax expenditures that is required by the Act.
I can interrupt for a minute.
Yeah,
there.
We've got those catalogs in front.
Yeah, on page 7 is where those sunset expenditures for this biennium, there's actually a small number compared to where we normally have, but those are things that have to be acted on through legislative action or that they will sunset and go away. So you'll see bills likely on all of these. The governor, you can see, has recommended extending sunset on 3 of them and on 2 of them to allow them to sunset. And those other 2 you'll probably see a bill on as well.
What about cigarette tax?
Well, the cigarette tax is not a tax expenditure. It's a
oh, that's sure.
It's a temporary rate increase.
That is, we do have that.
Yeah, I was thinking some sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I've taken those tax expenditures that you'll notice that before we talked about how they were split between the income tax, property tax, and other tax programs. This attempts to take those that we've classified into specific budget categories and just give you a sense for roughly how they are distributed by budget category. This isn't all the tax expenditures. Yeah. Some of the expenditures can't be categorized directly into the budget categories. There isn't a direct state linkage to these, but of those that can, this is how they're distributed. I can give you some examples of the types of expenditures that are included in these budget categories. For example, under the education category, this would include the exclusion of scholarship income. That kind of income is not taxed. There are charitable contributions that can be deducted for contributions to educational facilities. The Oregon Qualified Tuition Savings subtraction is included in here. And there's a property tax exemption for higher education parking facilities. Those are the kinds of examples that are in the education category. In the human services categories, this would include public assistance payments that are excluded from income, charitable contributions for health, medical savings accounts, rural medical practice credit. There's an income tax credit for medical personnel that practice in rural areas. So those are the kinds of things that are included in the human services budget category. In the economic and community development category, that would include such things as accelerated depreciation, working family child care credit, the research credit, affordable housing credit, and the strategic investment program property tax exemption. So a variety of types of economic and community development activities, but they fit into that budget category. And under the natural resource, examples there include the pollution control credit, alternative energy device credit, business energy facilities credit, farm machinery and equipment property tax exemption, and a historic property property tax exemption. And then finally, under the transportation area, this would include actually most of what's in that transportation area is really the fact that motor vehicles are exempt from the property tax. And that's there's an in lieu, there's a fee that corresponds to that, but strictly speaking, the property tax does not apply to motor vehicles here. So that's most of that 9%. It also would include employer-provided transportation benefits as well. That's excluded from taxable income at the federal level. So that's intended just to give you a flavor of that linkage between here how the expenditures fit in the budget category. And in your report, there are actually up front, I'll just draw to your attention, there are two indexes in the front of your report. The first index lists all of the tax expenditures according to tax program. So you can basically see all of the tax, first starting with the income tax, federal exclusions, and then the deductions, the Oregon subtractions and the credits, and then it goes through the property tax exemptions. This is on page 9 of your report, just so that you'll know there's that index that steps through them by tax. And then the second index that starts on page 17 basically shows all of those 350, but they're 350, but they're organized by program. So you'll see all of the education expenditures, all of the human services expenditures, and down the line. So the two indexes are really showing the same tax expenditures. They're simply organized in a different way. But those two indexes can kind of help you find your way around this report. Just to show, in terms of numbers, these were essentially this pie chart that I showed earlier. This is the chart, the slide that's on the screen now just shows you the numbers of expenditures and the dollar amounts that we have in these. And you can see that through federal law and some of these other categories, there's a huge amount of lost revenue to there, the $18 billion of the rest that can be directly assigned to programs. It's about $7 billion there that cleanly fits into the Oregon budget program categories. I mentioned that these tax expenditures need to be evaluated. I can tell you a little bit about how that evaluation process works. The first thing that happens each biennium is that the Department of Revenue identifies any new or modified tax expenditures that have occurred since the last report was produced. In this case, I think there were 23 new expenditures and about 45 modified expenditures. And these can be changed through federal changes in law that we then will flow through to Oregon, or changes that the Oregon legislature made last session that now need to be taken into account. These are all listed in the report. But the first thing is that the department identifies the changes since the last time. And the department then provides the information about these new or modified, as well as the existing tax expenditures, to agencies that have program responsibility or subject matter expertise. We ask about over 30 state agencies to participate in this evaluation because they have the subject matter knowledge of the particular programs. If there's a housing credit, there are a number of housing credits or property tax exemptions, we ask the housing agency to conduct these evaluations. So the initial part of this evaluation process is that the Department of Revenue is an information provider. We try to identify wherever we can the beneficiaries, what kind of revenue numbers we're talking about, just description of the program, how it works, and then we provide that to these roughly 30 agencies. The agencies then perform the evaluations, again, along those two lines. Does it accomplish its purpose, and is it the most fiscally effective means of accomplishing its purpose? And then those evaluations are reviewed by the Department of Administrative Services and ultimately the Governor's Office. So essentially, the Department of Revenue acts as the information provider in this evaluation process. Most of the evaluations, though, are conducted by state agencies that have program responsibility or subject matter knowledge. Paul mentioned, I think you've taken a look at these. These were the, as he mentioned, the governor, for those tax expenditures that are expected to sunset, he's required to provide his recommendation. Unfortunately, you've already looked at these. I want to talk just a little bit about the revenue estimating issues. Virtually every tax expenditure report starts with a discussion of the difficulty of adding up all of the, as I've done in a lot of these charts, I've added the totals, but in a technical manner, that's difficult to do for a number of reasons. But you'll notice every tax expenditure report that's written produces sort of some qualifiers about how it's, you have to be careful about adding these up, and then it provides tables of summaries for these tax expenditures. So we're no exception in that regard. But there's some issues that would be worth knowing here, I think, and one of which is that there are interactions between these tax expenditures that will affect the revenue impact. If you were to eliminate multiple expenditures, you'll have a different result than if you would eliminate one at a time because they interact with each other. Some property may be exempt under one statute, and that's how it's included in the revenue estimates. If that exemption were to go away, that property may qualify for another exemption. So the revenue yield from that may not be what the amount is indicated. There are also interactions between credits. You may have, for example, unused income tax credits, where if you were to eliminate one credit, the amount of unused credits might be able to come in and take its place. So this interaction between some of these tax expenditures make it a little bit tricky to add them up. But I think it is useful to provide those aggregates by program and by tax expenditure. It does give you an order of magnitude of how large these are. These are also static estimates in that they don't take into account any behavioral change that would result from the elimination of the tax expenditure. I'll point out an issue related to the property tax revenue impacts in that we report both what we call losses and shifts under the property tax exemptions. What this refers to is when property, if you think about property that is removed from the rolls and is not taxed, that will be a direct loss to the taxing district because it can't apply its rate to that particular property. And so that's what we are including in what we call losses. But if there is a, let's say there's a bond that's for a fixed amount for that taxing district, that bond will be repaid by the remaining property in the district. So essentially, the amount of that bond that's not paid by the property that's exempt will be paid by the remaining property. So that's essentially shifted to other owners of property. So in our property tax impacts, we report both losses, that is the amount that the districts are losing, as well as the shift amount, the amount that's being picked up. So the total of that loss and shift is essentially the benefit, if you will, to the taxpayers that are no longer paying that tax. And then finally, under the revenue estimate issues, is that we have our estimation methodology reviewed by Legislative Revenue Office and the Office of Economic Analysis. We work closely with both those offices as a matter of course, but in the context of the tax expenditure report, we do have a structured review before we publish it to make sure that we're on the right, the same path.
If I could just stop you there for a second, on those revenue estimates, I assume what we're looking here in the expenditure report, especially in the area of tax credits, for instance, wouldn't reflect current, the current level of estimated revenues, that is, where you've got credits against income. I would imagine some of the revenue impacts of these tax expenditures will actually be lower than what's reflected in the book because we're getting less corporate income, for instance, against those corporate credits?
Mr. Chair, we've attempted to take into account the December forecast on estimating these credits, but I think you're right. One of the things that will mitigate the potential revenue yield is some of these credits can be used, can be carried forward, right, as well as, for example, the pollution control credit is taken over a 10-year period. So if that particular credit was eliminated, there would still be those who had qualified earlier that would be claiming it for a number of years that would offset their taxes. But we have attempted to take into account the current, the December forecast in the estimates of these credits. But unused credits are another issue that taxpayers, if they can't offset all their liability in the current year, they can carry them forward in a lot of cases up to 5 years. So in summary, I might just mention that the report itself provides a great deal of detailed information about Oregon's tax system. I think it's a quite imposing book simply because of the magnitude of the amount of material. But I think if you find, if you look at the indexes and understand that there's one by tax program and one by budget program, and those indexes then will point you to the detailed information. The detailed information, I think we attempt to provide useful descriptions about how each of these work, two or three paragraphs, and a little description of who benefits. And I think you'll find, if you use the report, you can get some pretty good information about how these programs work. I also wanted to state in summary that the report is the result of work of over 30 agencies that conduct the evaluations and do the analysis around these the effectiveness of these programs. And finally, that we would appreciate any feedback you'd be willing to offer regarding the usefulness of this book. There is the statutory requirements of the information that's provided, but we would like to do everything we can to make this a useful publication for you.
All right. Questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hess.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As you know, this is one of my favorite subjects.
Uh-huh.
And as someone who's voted for probably every tax credit that's come down the pike, I still think that it's something that we should do this session in terms of taking a look at this. But what I don't know is what the most effective way to do this. I know you evaluated a lot of these, and I know that Vicatea Council recommended appointing a task force or an independent commission to look at all of these, similar to the way I think that the base commission, the military base commission, did on the federal level. And I think it would make sense to do something like that as opposed to us just sitting down here for the rest of the year and just going through one by one and trying, you know, to fight with each interest group out here that's defending each one. We'd be here all year. So it's kind of an interesting issue how you go about doing this. And it feels like one vote. I mean, when I look through here, I see that there are actually a lot of evaluations that said this is not achieving its purpose or not meeting goals, and it's a minority, but there are still a fair number of these. And so I guess I'm sort of still wrestling in my mind how you attack this. especially at a time when, while some of these might be good ideas, their expenditures at the same time were closing mental health centers and shopping school years.
It's a good question. It's interesting that on there is a corollary between the tax expenditure report and the appropriations process in Ways and Means, but of course in Ways and Means you do that every session. I mean, you look at every budget each session and you vote on each budget every session. Tax expenditure report, most of these are either not sunsetted or else the sunsets aren't coming up, and so they just kind of they establish and take on a life of their own, which makes it more difficult to evaluate them on an ongoing basis because you're just not called on to do that. So it does take a different kind of intentional effort. We'll talk about that. See, I can tell you from my experience in the 99 session that it would not be productive, I think, as you suggested, to start at page one and go through the book.
That was the 99 session.
That was the 99 session, yeah. I think we ended up creating a few and eliminating one or two, and I think we had about a $400,000 impact, as I recall. And so clearly some other approach is called for. But we'll talk about that. I think some of these are definitely going to be worth looking at as the session goes on. But that is how it's different than the Ways and Means process, because in Ways and Means you look at every budget each session and at least have a chance to ask those questions because it's there in front of you to be voted on, not so in the tax expenditure report.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, there are some of these that could be pared down if not repealed, and maybe reshaped or refocused, and I think that's a fair thing to do, but that's like a lot like work when you start evaluating to that extent. It's tricky.
You know, one thing that comes to mind, and this is dangerous to be thinking out loud, but one thing that, since we are going to have to work so closely with the Ways and Means Committee in this session, might be to ask Paul to work with Legislative Fiscal and identify these tax expenditures to the budget analysts who are working in each of these program areas, and actually have bring them to mind as the budget analysts are working on these budgets, because that may be a way to address budgets for some of these program areas as well. That may be a way to evaluate it in conjunction with the budget process, so that it is looked at as budgets are being built. And then if they identify some that are problematic, and in budget areas in particular where they're having trouble bringing the ends together to make the budgets balance, they may want to call those to our attention for action.
Mr. Chair, I do know that the fiscal office at the beginning of the session did identify the tax expenditure report as a tool they're going to use, so I can follow up on that and see where they're proceeding with that.
That would be worthwhile, I think, just to make sure that they're using it as part of their budget building process too. All right. Thank you very much. Very good information.
Thank you.
Now lottery.
Well, our lottery person. Kathy, you want to get Dick?
Oh. Okay, we'll stand at ease for a couple minutes until Dick Yates comes down.
Yeah.
Maybe we should schedule a meeting in before too long with
welcome Dick Yates to Revenue to give us the overview orientation on the state lottery.
Morning, Mr. Chair. If you'll give me a moment here to bring up my presentation, I'll be with you. Okay. Yeah, where it is here.
See, we're getting, we're building quite a file there.
Yeah. There's orientation presentations down at the bottom.
Well, it's supposed to be a separate folder that has that. Oh, it is a folder. Okay. Lottery. Sorry about the delay. Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. Just a brief sort of overview of the lottery. Things I want to talk about, a little bit about terminology, because there are some terms that are peculiar to the lottery. The history, in terms of how it was established and what changes have occurred since it was created by initiative petition. Then about revenues that come from the lottery. We talk about these generally as net proceeds, and they come either from the traditional lottery programs, which are basically tickets, where an individual plays against a pot in some sense, and then the video lottery, where basically the individual is playing against the machine itself, the only one involved. It's not a group. It's the main difference between the traditional and, the, and what's called the video lottery games. And talk about transfers. The difference between net proceeds and transfers is basically a one-quarter lag. The money comes into lottery, and then it's a quarter before essentially that's added up and transferred over to the economic development account. And that's the basis of the various distributions that occur. And then talk a little bit about some of the issues that may come up during the session with respect to the lottery. So again, moving into terminology, the first thing is revenue, and there's two types of revenue that we need to deal with. One is game revenue, which is basically, again, the basis of the individual games that are being sold or marketed, and then other income, which is interest on the money that is in the lottery's account before it goes into the economic development account, and also unclaimed prizes. Now, unclaimed prizes are primarily an aspect of the traditional games. Video lottery, pretty much, when you leave the facility, the retailer, you go to the cashier and cash out, and there's very little unclaimed lottery prizes. With the traditional game, there seems to be quite a bit, several $1 million in terms of unclaimed prizes, where people have a scratch ticket or some kind of lottery ticket, and they just don't bother to cash it in. Or at least there's a lag in terms of when they get cashed in and when they're actually earned. Prizes, then, is what individuals receive as a result of playing the game. Now, that differs a little bit with a lottery ticket, an instant game ticket, for example. There's, it says you won $2, $20, $2,000, whatever you won. You simply cash it in for that amount. In the video lottery, prizes are essentially what you get from the cashier, the money that you actually receive once you've played the game, plus the number of games you won. So that tends, that's the way lottery counts that. You could count it just as the amount of money the individual wins, but traditionally within the industry it's counted as prizes won plus the amount of money that is actually received as a result of the game. And that tends to make prize was very large in the video lottery. The first term we need to be concerned about is net receipts, and what this is game revenue less prizes. So it does not include interest and does not include unclaimed prizes. This is the basis of the distribution to the county. So it's before any expense has been taken out. You next then have expenses which are specific to each game. For instance, the instant scratch tickets that they sell. There's a certain cost of the tickets. There's certain costs that are specific to that game. Then a lottery's overall operating expenditures, which are somehow allocated among all the games, but they're not specifically identified with any particular game. Also an expense, it's not an expense in a sense, but there's movement of money into and out of reserves, which tends to be a reduction in net receipts before you get to net proceeds. And it's net proceeds that are the basis to the Economic Stabilization Fund, Parks and Natural Resources, and basically what's left over for the legislature to appropriate. So net proceeds then are net receipts less expense. The history of the lottery, basically it was created in 1984 by initiative petition, and that at that time included only the traditional games, and it dedicated all net proceeds to economic development. And it was up to the legislature to define essentially what economic development was. So when appropriations were made, basically they had to be justified as creating or contributing to economic development. In 1989, the legislature took action to create the Sports Action Lottery, which is a separate game. Money goes to higher education for student scholarships. In 1989, the legislature also authorized video lottery, but it was not implemented. The governor suspended it. They came back in 91 then, and the legislature did implement video lottery and prohibited what were called the gray games, which essentially are any private lottery games. Those are outlawed in Oregon. There's no competition for the lottery. At this time, it also dedicated 2% of the new game, essentially video lottery, 2.5% of the net receipts from video lottery to the counties. In 1995, the legislature referred measure number 21, and this expanded the uses of lottery revenues to include financing public education. It also gave lottery bonds the first claim on lottery revenue, and it dedicated 15% of the net proceeds to the Education Endowment Fund. Then in 98, through initiative petition again, ballot measure 66, 15% of net proceeds were dedicated to parks, beaches, and watershed protection. In 1999, the legislature dedicated not less than 1% of video net proceeds to problem gambling. And then in the special session, the third special session, sent again a legislative referral, which converted and was passed and converted the Economic Endowment Fund to the Economic Stabilization Fund. And it changed the dedication conditionally. If the fund balance, that is the balance in the Economic Stabilization Fund, is less than 5% of the prior year's prior biennium's general fund, then 18% of lottery revenue, lottery net proceeds, goes into the Education Stabilization Fund. Once that fund achieves the 5% balance, no more money goes into it unless it again falls below the 5%. But once it's when it's above, no more money goes into the Education Stabilization Fund. 15%, then not 18, but 15% of net proceeds goes to the school capital matching subaccount.
Chair?
Yes.
Where are we? I mean, what would that figure be then now? What do we need to
do? We got it ways to go.
Yeah. that's what I'm kind of asking about is, what would that be? Or is it?
Well, based on estimate for the 0305, what's our general fund forecast?
5% of what? So we need to get over
550.
Yeah, well, the 5% would put us at 500 million, about
50 million.
Yeah, about 500 million, and we are estimating that after the transfer takes place, there's 150 million transferred to the state school fund on May 1st. After that takes place, we'd have 128 in the fund. Well, that's the estimate at the end of this biennium. So we would be. And we did some projections out, I think it was 2013 is about the time we would hit the cap under the projections at that time, assuming no further withdrawals.
And then that starts going into the capital fund?
Yes.
At 15%.
The other thing that the special session did was to allow the legislature to appropriate the principal out of that stabilization fund. But again, that's conditional. It requires a three-fifths vote of each house of the legislature, and it requires that certain economic conditions exist for that to happen, or that the governor declares an emergency. Looking at revenues, net receipts, the only way I can really look at individual lottery games within the traditional framework is to look at net receipts, because the expenses in general do not apply to individual games, but are operating expenses, which are simply spread across all of those games. So if you look at net receipts, you had $113 million in total, and 38% of that came from the instant. Get my mouse. Here we go. Came from the instant games. Now, actually, instant games is not a game, but a series of games which occur over time. And lottery is continually offering new games and marketing those new games. And a lot of the advertising and a lot of the expense of lottery has to do with introducing these new games and informing the public of their existence and why they might be interested in playing those games. Keno is the second largest contributor. This is actually, it's on a video screen in terms of where you see the results of the draw. But again, it is a draw where there's a large number of players involved who may win or lose. So it's a traditional game, not a video game in the sense that it's a poker game or something where you're playing against the machine. Then you have the multi-state lottery and megabucks, which again are drawings. And the multi-state is tending to contribute substantially more than Oregon's megabucks. About 3% of the total lottery then is going to higher ed in the sports action. And then the daily four is an individual game producing about 2%. And then there's two other games at this time, which is Cash Quest and something else, which I've lumped together here as other. If you look at the history of the traditional game revenue, you can see that the top of these bars is the total revenue, total sales essentially from those games, a period of growth, but basically not much growth lately in terms of revenues from those games.
I think what's significant, and we remarked on this in special sessions, is not so much the fact that there's been not much growth, but not much, no decline.
That's true.
Contrary to what we've seen in our income tax receipts.
That's true. That's true. So from the standpoint of the interest to the legislature, I guess, is the green line at the bottom. That's essentially the amount of money that's coming to you that you have available for appropriations or that goes into these funds, the Education Stabilization Fund and so on. And that is fairly constant in the last 3 years here, around $56 million. If you look at these in terms of percent of the total, you can see that prizes are important and that the percentage of the play, which goes back to the players, has increased and has increased recently. And so it's always a question of where that should be set, and that's a lottery commission essentially that determines where that is set. The objective is primarily to increase the green line at the bottom there. The larger the payback percent there, the more enhancement or enticement there is to play the games. So the larger are your sales, and so through that mechanism you try to increase what's left over at the bottom. Moving then to video lottery, that did not start here until 1991. We see significant growth in video lottery. Again, you see the dominance of prizes in video lottery. At the bottom, again, is it looks very small, but of course we're dealing with very large numbers now relative to the traditional games. So while you see only about $300 or $400 million here in terms of revenue generated, you've got billions of dollars in terms of prizes that's actually moving around out there as a result of these games. Again, if you look at that in terms of percent, you can see the domination and the growth to a certain extent in the amount of prizes. And again, you've got that same problem of how large should the prizes be. It tends to encourage play, and question then, does it result in higher net revenues or revenues available for legislative purposes? Putting the two together, what you see primarily is the dominance of the video lottery. In the early period, we just had the traditional game, and then as you move into the more recent history, the dominance essentially of video lottery. Again, percentage-wise, doesn't it just, again, primarily shows you the dominance of video lottery and the importance of prizes in the overall total sales of video lottery. Looking at where the money goes, what we've got essentially are the possible areas of distribution. In other here, I've included sports action and the gambling addiction money. Those are fairly small amounts, which did not really show up in the bar chart, so I lumped them together. Then you've got money going to the counties, to parks and recreation, to the economic stabilization fund, and to bonds. Now, bonds really have first claim on the resources, on lottery revenues. It's not clear what the pecking order is among these others, but clearly the balance is what's left over after those dedications are made. So again, in the beginning, you see that all of the net proceeds of the lottery were available essentially for legislative appropriation. In 1991-95, you see the beginning of sports action taking a small piece. And also with the with video lottery coming in at this time, a small amount of money going to the counties. As you move into the 93-95, you see Westside Light Rail essentially making a demand on lottery revenues for bonding. Again, the counties and the sports action. This sort of continues lottery growth, resulting in an increase in transfers during this period. As you move into 97, you have the education at this time endowment fund picking up 15% of the distributions. And as you move into the last biennium, well, the 99-01 biennium, you have 15% going into parks. Some growth here in the dedication of lottery revenues to bonding. And as you move into the biennium, which we're now finishing, again, you see substantial growth in the amount of lottery revenue dedicated to bonding. In this period, while lottery revenues remained about constant, the amount available to the legislature diminished because of the other allocations. Now, you find a big jump here, and this is primarily because lottery agreed to take a substantial amount of money. I think I don't remember what it was now, but a substantial amount of money out of their reserve. To reserves that they had accumulated to introduce new machines and transfer that because of the revenue problems that the legislature was having. This did result in an increase in the amount of money available to the legislature for appropriation. It also increased the transfers to the stabilization fund and to the economic development fund. As you look into the biennium ahead of us now, what you see also during the 2001 was the substantial use or dedication of lottery revenues for bonding purposes. So the black here, the amount of revenue required for debt service, expanding the amount of money available to the legislature for appropriation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. In the current biennium, 2001-03, what were the major projects that caused such a large jump in bonding debt service?
Paul, can you help me with this?
Lottery bank bonds.
I could get that for you, but no.
Okay. Well, it was mainly through the bonding program, both 97 and 99 for schools.
Operation.
And it was a operation, but it was for capital that was outside measure 5 definition. Okay. It was for equipment, desks, and that kind of thing. So they were both 97 and in 99, there were lottery bonding programs enacted.
Right. Representative Virgin?
Yes, with the it's going back a little, but is the amount of money that's put into prizes, was that a result of competition with the other casinos?
I can't really speak to the decision. Again, this is a commission decision. Their objective primarily at this time, I think, was to maximize the amount of revenue that's generated by the lottery. Certainly they had that problem, was facing them. And how important that was in their decision, I don't know.
I guess my comment is that they were maximizing revenues, but primarily to go back to the players.
Well, by increasing the amount that goes back to the players, you generate more play. And the question is whether, as a result of generating more play, the residual, the net revenues, also grow. And you know, that's the question. That's... You had all of those players before the commission, the lottery retailers themselves, as well as just the people involved in the industry, inputting information to the commission and the commission making a decision about what that should be.
And I can add, Representative Verger, that the lottery did over this period, I believe, commission 2 studies on tribal gaming and what the payout rates were and what the size of the market was. So they were clearly looking at the revenue that was coming from on the tribal casinos and seeing, you know, what kind of relationship there might be here.
All right. Go ahead.
Looking at the last year then, we had essentially $680 million distributed from lottery revenues, and starting out with bonds, which had first claim on those resources, 13% going to bonds, 15% into the Economic Stabilization Fund and also the Parks and Natural Resource Account, 3% to the counties. Then the rest of this, which is about 54%, was available essentially for legislative appropriation. 42% of that went into the state school fund, 12% then going to other uses, primarily related to economic development. Issues then that you may come up during this session, and I've just tried to lay out some things here that I can foresee. The question of line games, the question again of the video payout percentage, whether or not, I've not seen any legislation that might deal with that directly, but the legislature might perceive its responsibility in this area in some sense to look at the issues that are involved. Retailer compensation is an issue that has come up a number of times, and we do have bills this session which address that question. The same is true of lottery expense. And again, with respect to advertising, which is a subset of expense, if you like, there has in the past at least been issues about lottery. So looking at each of these, what we have with respect to line games...
Sir Dickinson, Representative Bridger, had a question about that.
I have a question about that. On the retailer compensation, it's not exactly on the compensation, but it's on the number of machines that are allowed. Was that a lottery commission decision to have 5 machines and no more than that?
No, ma'am. Representative, the Constitution specifies that there'll be not more than 5 machines in a given location. Um, With respect to the Lion Games, what we have available at this time is an estimate made by lottery and given to the first special session. So it was in January of 2002. Well, the estimate as of February 2002 is that implementing Lion Games for the upcoming biennium would raise $80 million. Now, that's going to diminish as time moves because there is a lag. Even though the lottery is fairly well geared to shift to Lion Games. Maybe I should come back again in terms of the terminology, what a Lion Game is.
Thank you.
Video poker now basically is, or video lottery is a poker game, and that's the only game you can play. There's a lot of different kinds, whether it's stud or draw or whatever. A Lion Game is more like what you see in Nevada or someplace with a slot machine where you have several different locations and different symbols can come up on that location. Yeah. And if you get three of the same symbols in a line, you win. So for that reason, they're called line games. Okay, and those tend to be, I guess, more popular, at least in the Indian casinos and also in other states where that is available to them. It tends to draw more interest among the players.
Mr. Chair?
Let me make sure, Representative Berger, did that take care of your question?
That was my question.
Okay, Representative Farr.
Oh, nothing.
Oh, who's that? Was that you, Representative Hess? Sorry,
just was my understanding that the Lottery Commission could do line games, that there's it's not a legislative issue or unless they could prohibit it?
I think you're correct. I guess my feeling is that they're not likely to do that unless it's consistent with what the governor wants to do.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Williams.
Sort of on that same vein, and I think Representative Hass, I may even have a Legislative Council opinion that I requested some time ago that identifies the parameters of what we can and can't do, but I think you're right. The Commission can go to line games if they choose without legislative approval. And in fact, I don't think there's anything we can do legislatively, even if we passed a law statutorily that said we don't like the idea. Constitutionally, they still have the right to do it.
They're that fourth branch of government.
They are that fourth branch of government. Dick, do you recall how much the lottery still has in reserve for machine upgrade purchase for their video terminals?
Not off the top of my head. I can't remember. Okay.
Do you know how far down the road they've gone? I know they had a certain amount of money set aside to start doing those terminal replacements. I know they contributed some of that surplus back in the last legislative session and in some of the rounds of us looking for money. But do you know, have they gone forward with that? I know they had entered into contracts or had started to.
They entered into contracts for phase one. Phase one is being implemented, which I think is about half of the project. Phase two, I don't know where they are now in terms of whether they've entered into any contracts for phase two.
And your recollection was phase one would replace about half the terminals?
Yes. Half of the ones that need to be replaced. Yeah.
Right. Well, I guess needs to be replaced is sort of a judgment call, isn't it?
Well, in their mind.
Yeah, in the lottery's estimation of terminals that need to be replaced.
They do have some serious problems in terms of terminals. The only way they can keep them running is by retiring other terminals and salvaging the parts from those because they're not available anymore.
What I find amazing about that is that despite the alleged problems with terminals, the revenue just doesn't seem to go down. So if they're working with fewer terminals, those terminals must be getting more turns on them because you would think that we would start to see a decline if, in fact, terminal usage problems and game availability and the lack of new games was really having an impact. You would think it would demonstrate itself on the revenue, but it doesn't seem to do that, which I find rather amazing.
Well, you never know what the counterfactual world is. You know, I mean, maybe if they had all those new machines, the revenues would just take off.
Oh, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that at all. I think the ultimate question that we ought to be posing is whether or not we think that's a good thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The next issue, then, to move on to the payout percent. Looking at the video prize payout percent, this is what it's been since it started. It started out around 88.5%, and basically pretty constant there, increasing slightly through 96, 97, and then took off and has increased moderately recently. The question I had is, well, you know, how do I make any sort of judgment about whether this is good or bad? And I'm not sure how to answer that question, but the way I proceeded was to say, okay, let's compare the growth in gross revenues with the growth in net revenues. Assumption basically is what we're interested in is continued growth in net revenue. And so comparing those, again, the prize, the growth in the prize, even though percentage growth from 88 to 94 is not large, so the green bars here tend to be pretty small. In the first case here, that's actually negative. And then small growth, this period of fairly large growth in the lottery percent. Well, what happens during this period? We see strong growth in gross receipts. So that's the level of play that's taking place. And in this period, when the prize percent actually went down, you saw stronger growth even in net revenue. Then you move through this period where you've got fairly constant but somewhat growing prize percent, and you still see strong growth in both gross receipts and net receipts. So, you know, basically I would say the objective is to keep this light blue bar positive. What you want is growth in net revenue. We do see in this one period where there were fairly large increases in the prize percent, it was substantially less or even negative growth in net revenue. It's not quite clear here as you move, you know, what sort of lags are involved, what sort of adaptation or how does the market adapt to the change in the percent, because we move over into this next year and you've still got a growth in the percent, a small growth, but net revenues have also grown significantly. So throughout the period, at least, we've seen growth in net revenue. So it's pretty hard to judge whether that percentage is right now, whether further increases would be good, whether reducing that percentage would, in fact, increase net revenues more. But that's sort of a decision that has to be made. It's a decision that's currently made by the Commission. Moving then to video compensation rates. Originally, I think when the lottery started, retailer compensation was 35%. At that time, they experienced some very large individual retailers and a lot of concern about the fact that their annual net receipts here were over $1 million and they were getting to keep 35%. As a result, lottery implemented this schedule so that up to $200,000, you get 35%. The next 200,000, you only get 30%. The next 200,000, 25%. And anything over 600,000, then the retailer compensation is 20%. And what this averages, or averaged last year at least, for the lottery was 32%. So the average retailer compensation is 32%. Well, the question then is, can we vary this? Or if we vary this, what impact is that likely to have on net revenues that are available to the legislature, or essentially transfers from the lottery? And primarily, that depends on how sales, essentially, or gambling activity is related to this compensation percent. And so I've looked at two situations here. The first one is this, looks blue here, but it's supposed to be dark green. I guess it's dark green. Line is assuming that gross revenues are independent. Whatever percentage you want to charge here or whatever allow for retailer compensation is not going to increase the overall play of the lottery or reduce it. If that's true, then this light green line shows how net revenues would result from changes in the retailer compensation ratio. At 32, you're here. These gross revenues generate net revenues of about $300 million. What you would expect then is if you were to reduce the retailer compensation rate is that you'd move along this green line, essentially substantially increasing the net revenues that are available to the legislature. And this suggests that, in fact, if you moved all the way back to zero, you'd get the full gross revenues available as net revenues, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So I tried to, through logic, because I don't have any data, figure out what might be a reasonable relationship between retailer compensation rates and total gross revenues. And what I have basically is some logic that says, okay, if you go to zero, you know, the machines are going to be out in the alley and lottery's going to go pick them up. And there's not going to be any play. So it's going to go to zero. And the other logic, economic theory, says, you know, what's happening here is that the lottery cannot advertise the video. So all the advertising is basically done by the retailer. So you have retailers spending money either through making nice facilities so people will come into play, other things that might attract people to play, and also advertising. And what I'm suggesting with a log linear relationship here is that for each additional dollar they spend trying to encourage people to play, they get less play. So you have diminishing marginal returns, essentially. So it suggests some sort of log linear relationship like this. Now, what the actual relationship is, I have no idea. But if you accept this as a reasonable relationship between gross revenues and the retailer compensation rate, it suggests this red net revenue relationship. And where you are now is kind of at the top end of the flat period here. Clearly, if you further increase retailer compensation, it's going to reduce net revenues. Now, if you back off, and this is, you know, there are bills that suggest backing off on retailer, reducing the retailer compensation rate. This analysis suggests they're not going to have a large impact on net revenue, that they are going to be fairly flat. Now, if you were to back them off down to like 10% or something, again, clearly it's going to have a negative impact on net revenue. But that, at this point, about the best I can offer you in terms of trying to analyze. You know, the question is whether you want to get involved in that question or, again, leave it to the commission. The commission takes action, again, based on testimony that comes to them from the various players. And the question of whether the legislature wants to get involved in that decision. And it, this is sort of what you have to look at if you want.
Yes, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not for a moment to let you think I didn't understand every word of what you said. But the bottom line, what you're saying is, according to your analysis here, if we decrease the retailer's cut, so to speak, it will not necessarily increase our state revenue piece?
That's correct. It could clearly reduce it. The analysis here suggests it may have small marginal positive impact on revenue. Within that, this is about, if we sort of come back to, you're getting around 13-14% here, so you've got a range of from, it's hard to tell what that range is, but say from 15-32%, where it's pretty flat, it's not going to have much impact. If you're within that range, it's probably not going to have much impact. If you get lower than that, it will. If you go above 32%, it's also going to reduce revenue. So you have two effects to consider here. One is, obviously, by increasing the retailer compensation rate, you're sort of encouraging the overall play, the extent of gambling activity, because you're rewarding them enough that they can advertise the game, they'll do things to make the facilities nice where people play and so on. And they'll have, as you know, five machines. So you're kind of, it looks like, following this analysis, and I don't want you to accept this fact in any way, you're kind of at the upper end If you reduce the percentage, you won't have much effect on revenues that are available to you, but you will have some effect on reducing the overall play.
Okay.
Lottery expense, again, the red line is the traditional, and actually the total is also just the traditional before 91 because there was no video. And in the analysis here, what you see is this really sort of fluctuating around 16%, which is the constitutional limit. Now, there's some fuzziness in my numbers here because the lottery, in addition to its expense, has this other little thing called administrative savings. And I don't quite know how to treat that. But anyway, they're probably within their constitutional limit of 16% up until this period. This early period, of course, part of their problem was paying back money to them from the state general fund to start the lottery. But once you move past about in here, there was a decision essentially by the AG that the 16% applied to the total line, not to each game separate. So the 16% constitutional limit applies to the total lottery expense, and they're well below that. They're nowhere near the constitutional limit. So what you face if you want, again, to bring into the legislative environment the question of what lottery expense should be, you face the question of how to deal with this. Do you want to just deal with the total, or do you want to deal with the two different kinds of games separately? And if you do, you're talking about, you know, right now where they're operating somewhere around 3 to 4% of total. When you count again total sales for video lottery as not only dollars that go into the machines but also games won, you get a very large number, so that expense is a small percent of that. Advertising there. Advertising is a little bit like retailer compensation in the sense that what determines this is the relationship between sales and advertising. And I had some data from the lottery in terms of what their sales were for scratch-type games, traditional games, and the amount that they spent on advertising. And the best relationship I could find, again, through regression analysis, was a log linear relationship, which specified sales primarily as a function of the log of advertising expenditures. I also have per capita personal income in the equation, and a dummy variable which separated out the first couple of years and just said they're different in a sense because that was a good startup period and it didn't fit with the other data. The regression in terms of how you evaluate statistically regressions looks good. R-squared of 99.4%. The F-value, which is a measure of the significance of this 106 coefficient, highly significant from it ain't zero. So it's a reasonable regression. And if I take this regression and estimate what sales would be over this period, I get a fairly good relationship.
Why does that remind me of a beautiful mind?
What I appreciate most, Mr. Chair, is the humor that Dick finds in his own slot.
That subtle humor of the dummy value. Yeah. I caught that. That's where we come in.
I think, Mr. Chair, the dummy value should be, if I count correctly, should be 9 or 10. Only 5.
Well, Dick, we will take you at your word at whatever that slide says.
Mr. Chair, I actually want to try to have him translate it. I think what you were really saying is that advertising matters.
Yes.
All right, okay. Make sure I got that.
And, you know, common sense leads to that conclusion anyway, because businesses advertise their products. If I use that function to estimate sales, so that the sales star here in the chart is the result of that equation. So it's got per capita personal income in it, it's got advertising expenditures. And so you can see basically it is following the actual data, the green data. the actual trade-off. What does this suggest? Well, the implications of the equation are is if you spend an additional dollar in advertising or on advertising, that will add $14.25 to sales. And then giving the relationship between sales and transfers, that'll add another $3.13 to the transfer. So the implication, again, is if you were to restrict the level of advertising which the lottery currently engages in, that it would have a negative impact on revenue. And again, to the extent that this equation is anywhere near reality, it suggests that maybe lottery is even under advertising if your objective is to maximize net revenue.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Remind me again of what transfers are?
That's the money that's left over that the lottery can actually give to the education or to the economic development fund.
Okay.
And and those monies then go out to, you know, lottery bonds.
Okay.
So that's it.
Thank you, Dick. I think we went from lottery 101 to graduate level there. Speed course. But good information and useful as we will go look at this through the session. Are there questions for Dick? Anybody there? want to go through that slide again?
Yeah, just one sales thing.
No. All right. Thank you, Dick, very much for that overview. With that, tomorrow we have a couple of bills, and I hope a short meeting, colleagues. I have to leave at 9 tomorrow, so we'll try and power through a couple of simple bills. They're collector's bills, is that it? Tax collector's bills. Mm-hmm. So let's try and start promptly at 8:30, and then Wednesday, no meeting. Is that right? I'll be out there.
We do have Wednesday's a meeting scheduled for Wednesday.
Thursday's
we have
no meeting.
Public hearing on a couple of bills that have kind of broader implications, and then no meeting Thursday.
Okay. And then. So with that.
That's right.
And then Friday we have our orientation. Is it labor or public?
Yeah, Friday we go through the same policy discussion we had last Friday, only from a labor perspective.
Tax implications.
Economic development and revenue policy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. We are done then for today. We will see you tomorrow morning at 8:30.